Good morning. It is 11 a.m. and you're tuned in to CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Christina Laurie, and this is Kingston Currents. CFRC's news programming is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. What you just heard is the main strike line in front of Stauffer Library at the intersection of Union and University, as over 2,000 graduate students are now on strike after negotiations with the university failed to yield a new collective agreement. After 15 hours of bargaining leading up to the deadline on Sunday, March 9th, picket lines have been set up at entrances across Queen's campus since Monday morning. Some of the union's demands that have not been met include a guaranteed funding model, compensation for the creation of course content, and tuition relief. PSAC Local 901 Union President Jake Morrow spoke with CFRC at the picket line on campus.
What's the experience been at the picket line these past few days?
The experience is joyful. It's a tough thing to go on strike, but our membership has shown up in huge numbers, in growing numbers every day. Got over 1,000 folks so far signed up for picket shifts over the next couple days. We've got solidarity and support coming from CUFA, from local counselors and politicians, from the other unions on campus, from national unions and labor organizations, from local unions such as bus drivers, transit. We've got solidarity and support coming from everybody. You can hear the honking in the background. We're just taking the first couple days to practice some logistics of what it means to be on strike, and we are getting ready to shut this university down. We got 2,000 members who are getting ready to shut this university down and a whole community.
And you mentioned some of the support you're getting there. What support are you seeing from students, your fellow faculty and staff?
Just love. Just how do we help? How are you in such poverty? How is it so embarrassing to be at Queen's University in this moment? We're getting solidarity, love, and support from undergrads, and we want to keep seeing it.
While Queen's has stated that classes and academic activities will continue as scheduled, some undergraduate students are seeing classes canceled or otherwise impacted, with many relying on teaching assistants, research assistants, and teaching fellows for tutorials, labs, and grading. Queen's faculty are also able to choose not to cross the picket line on ideological grounds without repercussions. Nathan Percy, a first-year Queen's Law student, shared his thoughts on his professors choosing to continue classes.
It hasn't directly affected most of our classes, actually, which is something that irks me personally. I know that the QUFA union members, which I believe are the faculty, would be the main professors, have a provision in their collective bargaining agreement that allows them to not cross picket lines on ideological grounds, or make that decision with no recourse. And all of my professors have elected to continue in-person classes. So it hasn't really affected our main courses. One course of ours, Introduction to Legal Studies, has TAs and heavily relies on TAs to facilitate and mark assignments. So that's the only one where it's kind of up in the air, and we haven't had received any communications regarding how we're affected, let alone what it will be affected. I know some of my friends said their TA was out on the picket line, so we really have no idea. Usually we have that class on Tuesday, and we didn't even get an email about it, so we'll see what happens. I think it, you know, heavily depends on how long the strike goes, obviously.
While law classes have been minimally impacted so far, Percy spoke to how the strike has changed how he shows up on campus.
I have two classes that I have to attend to get our participations are a large part of our mark, and so therefore attendances. And so I will attend for those, but I have skipped the rest of my classes, and I won't use the library or the ARC or anything in accordance with PSAC's requests. It's funny. I don't know how much like the rest of my class engages in that kind of action. I actually had one of my peers ask me, why are they asking us not to use the library or the ARC? you know, we pay for those. Why would we stop using them? I wonder how much people and even my peers in law school really understand about like what a strike is substantively outside of, oh, the workers are stopped working.
Percy also elaborated on what he has been hearing from his peers on the subject.
I think it's very mixed. I think I certainly have peers who share my view on the labor dispute, and we pretty much agree with everything when it comes to when we talk to each other. But I also have peers who, like I said, aren't outwardly anti-union. I haven't really heard a lot of that sentiment, to be fair. But you know, I have heard a lot of like I spoke to before, owing to like a certain confusion or a lack of true understanding of like what labor disputes like this like mean.
In their latest statement, the university simply stated that it remains committed to working with the union to reach an agreement that both parties can ratify.
What's outrageous? What's outrageous?
The fate of the Limestone City Cooperative Housing Project came before council at their meeting on Tuesday night, where they ultimately decided the project will have to fend for itself to secure the intended property at 900 Division Street. Limestone City Cooperative Housing, LCCH, is a nonprofit aiming to build an innovative cooperative housing and vertical farm project, providing 284 affordable housing units in the city's north end. Meadowbrook Strathcona Councillor Jeff McLaren has been working on the project for the last 2 years. In September, council turned down a request for $2 million in seed funding for the project, sending LCCH the message that a clearer vision for the project would be needed to win over council. On Tuesday, council was presented with two options: to hand over the city-owned property at 900 Division Street to LCCH or to put the property on the open market, meaning LCCH, a nonprofit, would have to compete with private developers for the land. Proponents of the project presented before council to support the project with option one. Remy Strauss, a business expert backing LCCH, was one of the representatives that presented the case before council.
While this is really big today, I think I question for you as to whether you want to see buildings as just places where people live, or are they perhaps a backbone for a thriving community? Are they perhaps more than just somewhere to live, but they're actually about addressing many more issues?
Councillor McLaren also emphasized the importance of choosing option one for LCCH, with the major hurdle being that the project cannot secure identified grant funding before securing land.
There's $127 million that we have identified that we can go after, but it's conditional on the land. We need that land to get the money. What I'm asking you guys here for today with option one is to help us, to authorize us, to give us the direction to go out and get a $127 million investment in affordable housing, in solutions to climate change, in solutions to food insecurity. This is absolutely critical in our community. We've declared emergencies in all of these things.
Councillors Connie Glenn and Gary Osteroff expressed their support for option one.
I think we owe it to ourselves as a community to at least make the attempt for a big reach, something that is going to solve multiple issues, multiple problems, and maybe set the stage for something brand new for other communities as well. So I'd like to see this move forward. Let's give an opportunity to this city to really shine and to see what we can actually bring.
I'm going to support this project. I've been a bit of a critic of it as well, and Jeff has heard me out a few times, but I did go to a board meeting recently and as a visitor, and I've been listening closer, and I think, as Councillor Glenn has said, a year ago we had a report that we sent back, pretty clear message. And I think that what we see now is something that is very attractive. This has really got to, there's a lot of check marks that we can now look at this and say, this is worth looking at. I think we should give this project the confidence that it needs tonight with option one. Really, it's inherently risk-free for us. And the upside is just so high.
However, while a major selling point for the project had been the lack of risk for the city, Mayor Brian Patterson brought in another perspective.
Do I want to see this project go forward? Of course. I think that the issue is that it's not risk-free for the city, because we only have so much land available. I'm not trying to be negative, but I am trying to be honest. So this is what due diligence looks like. So we need to weigh that out.
Option one did not make it through, with only Councillors Osteroth, Glenn, McLaren, and Lisa Osanek in support. Councillor McLaren made a final impassioned speech, stressing the position of LCCH if the land is put out on the market, and urged Council to reconsider.
If we're going to put this on the market, there is a long process, and it's an uncertain process, one that will close windows, that will make this harder for us. It creates uncertainty, and in fact, it's going to kill this project. We are not equipped to play or to compete in a for-profit shark-infested ocean.
Councillor Osanek expressed the disappointment of supporters of the project.
Option two is why innovation dies. I feel so strongly. I've been on planning committee for 18 of my 19 years. This is 248 affordable housing units that are 65% of market rate. I am so angry. It is so hard to get affordable housing units built in this city. Every single big tower, we always ask for affordable housing. The answer is always zero units. This is 248 right here in our hands that could have been on city land. So let's just see what happens with this option two that is probably going to pass right now. What we get is going to be, at the very best, purpose-built apartment. That will be the best. At the worst, it's going to be a tall condo. Tall condo. And how many affordable housing units will be in there? None. This is what we just gave up. 248 affordable housing units. I cannot believe in a housing crisis that we just said no to that.
When option two came forward, Councillor Brandon Tozzo made his case as the councillor of the district the project would take root in.
This project had more red flags than Soviet Russia. Assumptions of grant funding and financing that it hasn't really been proven. And this is a public piece of land. A point I also want to make is I'm the councillor of the district that this property is in. I have seen in my time on council a variety of different brilliant ideas proposed in the north end of Kingston that each have really unique features. And this is about the third or fourth time I've experienced this, and this seems to only happen in Kingston's north end. And let it be said, every single time in the previous report that we had on affordable housing, I voted in favor of this. I'm a fan of affordable housing, but I am kind of getting sick of being the city's social engineering experiment for the rest of the town. This is the north end, and I know it has had a lot of inequality and marginalization. This amount of affordable housing, staff recommend in the initial report that was supposed to have 5 affordable houses, that was ignored. The staff think that it could have a limitation of 6 stories, that was ignored. This is a kind of an affront to me as the district counselor that none of those considerations were even considered. So there was also a public meeting that Limestone Co-op had months ago where I wasn't invited as the district counselor. I actually asked about it and didn't get a response from the board. Thanks, guys. Really awesome. So on the merits of this project, I think it's just inherently flawed. I'm not going to be charitable about this. I kind of call a spade a spade. I'm voting against this. I think we should sell the land, put that directly into affordable housing, and we can actually get some affordable housing built. That's where I stand on this. Good luck in the free market getting this.
Option 2 passed with a vote of 7-4. While this means LCCH still has the opportunity to compete for the land, as Councillor McLaren stated, this could mean the end of the project. According to the motion, the city has the intent of reallocating revenue from selling the land to an affordable housing project located in another area of the city. Council has unanimously passed an advocacy-based motion concerning the future of Kingston Penitentiary, urging the federal government to reconsider listing the historic site as inventory of properties designated for housing development. In addition to striking the site from the list, the motion also requests that the federal government discuss a long-term lease for the city or a transfer of the property to Parks Canada, ensuring that the property remains a heritage site under federal stewardship. Kingston Penitentiary is Canada's oldest penitentiary, a major economic and heritage asset for the city. Kingston Pen has become a major tourist attraction, contributing to the local economy through guided tours, film productions, concerts, and other events held at the site. Tourism Kingston CEO Megan Knott spoke before council calling Kingston Pen an anchor attraction in Kingston's $500 million tourism industry. When asked to rank the penitentiary amongst Kingston's tourism sites, Knott had the following response.
Without the opportunity to experience Kingston Penitentiary from a leisure perspective or from a sales and business sector, it really would be catastrophic to the tourism community. If I was to rank all attractions across our community and looked at number of visitors and looked at repeat visitors and looked at the EI on those visitations, I would strongly probably come back to you and say the St. Lawrence Parks Commission, who couldn't be here tonight, would suggest to you that their financials would show you that it is the number one attraction ahead of Fort Henry, for example.
Kingston Pen Tour saw approximately 89,000 visitors in 2024. According to the St. Lawrence Parks Commission, tours and other events generated nearly $12 million in economic impact in 2024 alone. Councillor Don Amos brought the motion before council.
This is not appropriate. This is not an appropriate spot to be putting housing. This is an economic engine. It is the number one tourism economic engine for our city. Not appropriate to put housing in there. It is a heritage site.
Councillor Brandon Tozo offered hearty support of the motion.
I was one of the initial people who had a tour when the site was first opened to the public. And I remember walking into Kingston Penitentiary and like it had just been like vacated and just feeling that sense of mystery and terror and the smell of it. Like people had just been living there and just this sense of like, it was awesome. And horrifying at the same time, like just that feeling of emotions when you step into something old and unique as part of our history. And I just thought like this is something everybody in Canada and in North America needs to experience. This is the Alcatraz of the North. And the fact that this could be taken away by the federal government at the stroke of a pen is so infuriating. We can't lose this. This is such a valuable piece of Kingston history and of Canadian history.
Councillor Wendy Stevens stressed the importance of the second portion of the motion, which puts forward other federally owned land in Kingston which could be used for housing.
I'm just looking back at the motion. Staff have identified at least 340 hectares. So this is sort of in addition to leave the pen alone. Please have another look at the other properties that are available, because do we want to build housing on this? Yes, we do. This just isn't the right place for it.
Before we get into more local news, I'm going to turn to our weather and traffic report for this morning, featuring CFRC's Jesse Bell.
This is Jesse Bell with your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Friday, March 14th, a beautiful start to the weekend, a mix of sun and cloud, but a daytime high of 14 degrees, getting cut in half, dropping to 7 overnight. Saturday, March 15th, not quite as nice of a day. We are going to see rain, but a daytime high of 11 degrees, dropping down to about 5 overnight. Sunday, March 16th, 75% chance of precipitation, but we will see a daytime high of 12 degrees, getting cut in half, dropping down to 6 overnight. Moving into the start of next week, Monday, March 17th, cooling off a little bit, daytime high of 6 degrees with cloudy conditions, and then Tuesday, March 18th, we'll see a daytime high of 11 degrees and it will be cloudy. This is Jesse Bell with the City of Kingston Traffic Report for the week of Monday, March 10th, 2025. Reduced load restrictions are in effect in Kingston as of March 1st. Heavy trucks and loads are restricted on city roads where posted. These restrictions help reduce damage to roads in the spring. A complete list of roads with restrictions can be found in the Traffic Bylaw section of the City of Kingston website. Here are the relevant road closures for the week. Aberdeen Street, William 2 Johnson is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging. Albert Street, Princess to 486 Albert is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging at 484 Albert Street. Queen Street, Division 2 Barry is closed until March 14th for a contractor to cap a water service at 283 Queen Street. A reminder that there is still a parking disruption ongoing at the Hanson Memorial parking structure as the restoration project is now underway. The work will take place throughout all levels of the building and will include efforts such as routine structural maintenance, repainting, replacement of waterproofing materials, and upgrades to the building's mechanical and electrical systems. The work is set to conclude in July 2025. Here are some other delays to be aware of. Front Road, Sand Bay to Country Club. Expect delays for the installation of sanitary and water main for Utilities Kingston. Traffic will be reduced to one lane in each direction. Please be aware of lane shifts, traffic speed limits, and share the lane signage. Highway 2, Abbeydon to St. Lawrence. Expect delays to complete enhanced flood protection of Abbeydon Road, Highway 2, and St. Lawrence Avenue.
Thank you, Jesse. Now back to more local news. At their last meeting, council voted unanimously to formally withdraw the city's support for Via Rail and the federal government's recently announced high-speed rail project. In 2017, Via Rail asked communities along the Quebec-Windsor corridor for their endorsement of Via's proposed high-frequency rail project. According to the motion and Mayor Brian Patterson's recount of the events before council, the city supported Via's HFR project with the promise that although Kingston would not be a stop on the proposed line, it would become a Via Rail regional hub in eastern Ontario with increased service and more trains starting and ending in Kingston. The federal government announced in February that instead of the HFR project, they are going full steam ahead with a high-speed rail project called ALTO, with a route that bypasses Kingston and no commitment to a regional hub in Kingston. Mayor Patterson, who put forward the motion to withdraw support from the project, expressed his frustration at the change in direction.
The high-speed rail project that was announced just the other week is very different from the project that was initially shopped around by Via Rail a number of years ago. No promise, no commitment whatsoever to a rail hub in Kingston. In fact, when I raised it with Via Rail, they were surprised. They had no idea. They said, that's an interesting idea. We suppose that we can talk about it internally. As though the commitments and conversations that they had made to Kingston 8 years ago had never happened. I'm sorry, that's not acceptable. At the end of the day, right, rail service should be improved not only for people that live in Toronto or Ottawa or other stops along the high-speed rail line, but what about the million-plus people that live in between? Kingston and Belleville and Brockville and Port Hope and Cornwall. What happens to them? So Via Rail had it right 8 years ago. Invest in a plan that would make everybody better off. That's not what we have right now, and it's time for them to fix that.
According to the motion, Kingston is home to one of the top five busiest Via stations in the country. Councillors Don Amos and Connie Glenn shared their support for the motion as well as their own frustrations.
It shouldn't be an adventure when you hop on your train in Kingston and your fingers are crossed, hoping that you get to your destination within a reasonable time frame.
When I moved to Kingston 9 years ago, a huge piece of that was that from a business perspective, I could get to Toronto really easy. I could get to Ottawa easy. I could get to Montreal easy. It's not so easy. So for every person who's trying to do the right thing for the environment by not driving, for everybody who's trying to live here because they love it, but yeah, they might have some business interests and work that they need to accomplish there, it's a real problem. So I think Via needs to step up to the plate.
Councillor Glenn also brought up the impact unreliable service is having on the city across multiple sectors.
One of the things that Queens has identified as a deterrent to having students come here is the fact that they don't find it easy to get here. They don't find it easy to get home for a visit. So they'd rather pick someplace else because we're seen as being remote. So we got a late letter in from Queens talking about those issues. And it doesn't just impact their ability to get students, It also impacts the ability to get staff and faculty. One of the things that's really sort of become more common in the university sector, of course, if you've got, you know, a power couple, two profs, they might not work at the same university. So they've got to pick some place to live. And that means at least one of them's traveling. Well, they don't want to be traveling here because it's not easy to get here. So it's impacting multiple sectors, business, education, all of those things right now are under a lot of stress. And VIA is just sort of choosing to ignore that we're one of the largest hubs or possible hubs for transportation.
Along with the formal withdrawal of support for the project, the city will also be working on advocacy efforts with other cities along the Quebec-Windsor corridor that will be negatively impacted by the change of direction. The city has also requested representatives from VIA Rail Canada appear before council to explain the change in their proposal and next steps for increased rail service in Kingston. When asked for comment, VIA stated that VIA Rail is no longer the lead on the project, and that, quote, VIA Rail's role is now to provide advice on the technical and operational aspects of existing passenger railway services. They also stated that, quote, current and planned VIA Rail services will not be impacted by this high-speed train project, and opportunities to improve services on these routes to better address local needs will be further explored during the six-year development phase of the Aalto project. The federal government did not respond to CFRC's requests for comment. After announcing the festival would be folding in the first week of 2025, Kingston Writers Fest is now hoping to return for a 17th season in fall 2025. The festival sent out a message in January citing ongoing financial challenges as the downfall of the event, running in a deficit even with a scaled-down festival in 2024. However, with the launch of a fundraising campaign on February 1st, the festival may have a second chance. The festival's co-founder, Marilyn Simons, who served as artistic director from 2009 to 2014, stepped back into the spotlight this January to address the financial difficulties, launching an angel campaign. Simons described the events in an interview with CFRC.
I was artistic director from 2009 to 2014. My goal was to start the festival and to make it financially stable. But my real life is as a writer, so I left it at that point and stayed engaged as an audience member and certainly presented all my books there. In January, I became engaged with the festival again in an attempt to solve some of its financial problems that arose last year.
I was wondering if you could speak a bit about this angel campaign and how that came to be after the announcement that Writers Fest was folding.
You know, like everyone, I received the same, sort of public announcement that everyone did. And, you know, I sat around mourning for a little bit because this was our baby. And then I thought, well, heck, maybe there's something we can do. And so I called up Jan Walter, who was my co-founder with the festival, and the current chair, and Justin Conitis, who's a longtime supporter of the festival. And together, we decided that we would mount an angel campaign, that we figured out how much was owing and how much we needed to raise. And at the same time, CRA decided that because of the postal strike, they were extending the deadline for 2024 charitable receipts till the end of February. So we started a 1 month campaign, and basically we just called up all the supporters of the festival that we could think of, and the response was just, oh, it was so gratifying. One of the writers that we had, we were the first festival to showcase her. And, you know, she wrote and said she would never forget that. And she gave us money. Lots of people all across Canada donated funds and became angels. So it was within a couple of weeks, we had enough money to start paying back, to start meeting the debts of Kingston Writers Fest. And now almost all of those debts are covered. We have some more money coming in March, and when that comes in, we will have retired all of the debts.
While covering 2024 debts was the original goal of the campaign, Simon says Writers Fest is now focused on rebuilding.
The enthusiasm was huge, and that itself was extremely not only satisfying, but invigorating for those of us who were working on this. We realized that, like us, people in the community really, really valued this festival, as did writers and publishers across the country. So that gave us the motivation to do the work, the second stage of the work, which is, the first stage was making, you know, sort of clearing the debt. The second stage is to rebuilding. And the third stage will be to plan the next step. And we're considering many things. Most importantly, a summer reading series and a somewhat reconfigured festival in the fall.
That soon, in September 2025, you think Writers Fest could be coming back?
Yeah, because, I mean, what a lot of people don't realize is that when we started this festival in 2009, we had our first meeting on March 27th. And on September 25th, we opened the doors to a festival with over 30 events, and we had an audience of more than 3,000. So we know this can be done.
There's more fundraising ahead, but what else do we need to get Writers Fest back on its feet? What's next?
I think planning. Mm-hmm. We put together a really good board that has a tremendous amount of skill in financial management, legal, governance, strategic planning, risk management. And so it will be the board's job to lay the groundwork for the next festival so that it can be sustainable and continue on. This community really loves this festival. There are people who have been coming every year for 16 years. And there are new readers who are just discovering it. So the work now will be mostly behind the scenes. We'll be having other fund development campaigns. We'll be probably mounting a couple of fundraisers. We'll be applying for grants. We'll be doing all the, you know, all the usual things that festivals have to do in order to give this gift of books to the community.
Simons also discussed the challenging landscape that put Writers Fest in jeopardy and what returning to the playing field could look like.
It's kind of a perfect storm of circumstances. COVID hit a lot of festivals of this size very hard, because people couldn't come out. So festivals had a variety of responses to that. Most of them had online events, but of course people don't pay for those, right? Mm-hmm. So you still have to keep your staff on, but you're not getting any money in. At the same time, a lot of the granting bodies reduced their grants. And people, I think a lot of festivals, their response to coming back to in-person events was to make their festivals smaller, not be too ambitious. And unfortunately, with something like this, you need a certain size in order for the festival to be sustainable. So there were a lot of things that kind of conspired all at once to do this. And Kingston Writers Fest isn't alone. I just heard that the Toronto Festival of Authors is moving off out of Harbourfront and reconfiguring itself, you know, for many of the same reasons. And I know of other smaller festivals that are in the process of doing the same thing. I personally, I work with a festival in San Miguel in Mexico. I live here half the year. And I worked with a tricultural festival here, which really struggled the last 3 years. And this year, people came back in droves. So all the events were sold out, and I'm talking 1,000-seat venues. And what was really interesting to me is that the demographic changed, is that there were far fewer, what I like to call Q-tips, whiteheads in the audience. The demographic, the age range was more people in midlife and younger. And so I think I feel encourages me a great deal for Kingston Writers Fest this fall, is I expect that the audiences will come out. It takes good programming too, and we're working on that. We have some fabulous ideas for programming. So I'm hoping that people will come out and we'll be able to develop a new audience of readers and writers.
The Angel Campaign will continue as Writers Fest prepares for its comeback in September 2025. And Simons remains hopeful that Kingston's reading and writing community will be able to keep the festival afloat.
I discovered very early on when I was working on Kingston Writers Fest and developing it, is that we weren't developing a festival so much as we were developing a community. And I think that's the hugely satisfying part of Kingston Writers Fest, is that readers and writers come together to talk about ideas and books, and it's a book love fest, really. And as a writer, there's no place I'd rather be.
That is all things current in Kingston for this week. Thank you for listening to CFRC's local news programming, brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. To listen on the go and hear more from some of our guests, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
What'll I Wear offers the best in vintage, funky, one-of-a-kind treasures, clothing, accessories, and a fabulous selection of jewels, vintage and new. Find the cutest purse, the most dashing of hats and sunglasses, everything to complete your individual look. What'll I Wear has it all. They can dress you from top to bottom. Find your new fashion fave at What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street in Kingston. Visit their new location and follow them on Facebook to keep up to date with what's in store at What'll I Wear.